For those of you who are not familiar with Richard Pitt, let me give you a quick introduction. Richard, on top of being a true homeopathic educator and scholar, is, from my perspective, one of the most important leaders in the homeopathic community because on top of being a very gifted practitioner, having his own school, instructing people in homeopathy really all over North America, Richard has sacrificed a tremendous amount of his personal time to do good work for homeopathy. And this was recognized this last year as he won the Henry Williams Award. And from my point of view, Richard deserves that award pretty much more than anybody that I can think of. So Richard has been the president of the CHC between 1995 and 2000. He was also the vice president between 1993 and 1995. He runs the Pacific Academy of Homeopathic Medicine in San Francisco. He's an extremely dynamic and amazing presenter with an immense amount of information to share. He's been practicing now for, I believe, over 18 years. This is somebody who we should all look towards, emulate, and strive to really become more like, because Richard has really sacrificed himself and done a tremendous contribution for homeopathy. So, Richard, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Kim. I appreciate everything you said.
It's all very true. and Richard recently has worked on two projects. He's just come out with a new journal called the California Homeopath, and so that's very exciting, and we'll ask him a little bit more about that later. And also, he's just recently released a book with the title Tobacco, An Exploration of Its Nature Through the Prism of Homeopathy, a wonderful new book on a very important remedy, and so we'll certainly be asking him about that as well. Richard, since the topic this evening really is on the focus of your new book, and this is a new proving, I thought I would just ask you some general questions about provings, and then we could get into the specifics of the book. Is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, Richard, in general, what do you see as the significance of provings today for the modern homeopath? Why should we do them? What's important about them? And maybe you could also talk a little bit about reproving old remedies versus having to prove new remedies. What is your thinking on this whole subject?
I think that both are needed to be done. I think it makes sense to have certain new remedies that we don't know about. I think for different reasons. One obvious reason is that there are obviously basic gaps in our materia medica for no apparent reason, I think, than the fact that they weren't chosen when the first major provers, Hahnemann, Herring, and company, first started to do them. They chose certain remedies, and of course they became part of the folklore of homeopathy and were used very effectively and have been, you know, for a long time. So on one level, I don't think in any way any of the remedies we have are obsolete, but there are obvious gaps. There's huge gaps in the botanical remedies and plant remedies that just need to be investigated a lot more thoroughly, as there are in mineral and metal remedies. So it makes sense to look at remedies and to keep investigating them. And at the same time, I think some of the old remedies, when we look at the original text, many of them haven't even been proven. Not really effectively, including the two remedies I recently proved, which is tobacco and petroleum. Mm. And so some of the substances I'm most interested in, whether they're old or new, are substances in which there has been a strong connection to human experience, where, you know, we have met them, human and nature, have met and interacted and had a lot to do with one another. I think those substances have more meat and potential about them than I think some of the more, say, obscure substances. And, you know, and personally I find some of what has been proven to be somewhat debatable, meaning that to do a proving takes a lot of effort and energy. And so it makes sense that we're going to prove something that's going to be productive and useful for the profession. And to be honest, some of them I don't find that interesting, or I think their usage is going to be somewhat limited. Whereas I think a remedy like tobacco, you know, I think outside, you know, coffee and tobacco are probably the two most popularly consumed substances known to man. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we should know more about it. So then I study tobacco, and I think, my God, the proving's all toxicology. And so if you look back in some of the original provings, a huge amount of information was taken from toxicological points of view.
Mm.
And if we understand homeopathy to be based on idea of energy and potency and different stratas of potentization and a different consciousness at each stage, then we need to know more about certain substances, and we need to look back at the substances that were not completely proven to see if there's more information that can be gleaned. And that's what led me to try and do a reinvestigation of tobacco.
Hmm. Well, you know, I think the point you're making is a very important one. It's always impressed me when looking at the original Materia Medica's, you know, Hahnemann's and so forth, that he wasn't really arbitrary in terms of what he chose. I mean, there was really good reasons for the substances that he chose to prove. So I think that certainly makes a lot of sense. Richard, you know, one issue that comes up a lot, and there's a lot of discussion about it in the homeopathic community, is how the actual proving should be conducted. There's people out there who, you know, have a kind of a more lax approach, you know, and there's even meditational provings or dream provings. And then there's those people who feel that we need to follow a more, you know, strict approach, and even, you know, proposing using single or double-blind cross studies. What is your perspective on all this?
I've gone from being a pretty sort of ardent, taking a conservative line on this and saying they have to be done really formally, with taking somewhat of a middle road right now. I'm by no means one of the more sort of broad provers, meaning I've only proven now 4 remedies. Some people have done 10, 20, and I've got a huge amount of knowledge and experience doing that. However, I think my experience, having done 3 provings in a very thorough, exhaustive way, is that sometimes the very methodology itself creates a certain redundancy and inaccuracy. If you've got 15, minimum 20, 25 provers, each with a supervisor, who take a remedy for 1, 2, 3 days, supervise over a period of 1, 2 months, and then all that information is collated and the data is processed and then analyzed, and then 1 year later you come out with the results, I think in that process sometimes it's like a dragnet when you're fishing. You get a ton of other stuff coming up with what you're trying to analyze. And to separate the other stuff in the net along with the real crucial identity and idea of a remedy, I think becomes more difficult in some ways more complicated the larger the proving becomes. It makes sense to do a proving with at least, ideally, 10 people. Although I still think you can get, you can get a taste doing it with less than that. And I think that's valid if you at least acknowledge that. But when you do it with large numbers, it makes the process complicated. And I think the art at that point is to discriminate clearly what is the proving and what is not. And this is the key thing that gets debated about. Because, and I agree with some people who critique a lot of the modern proving, saying a lot of what comes up, it's just basically background noise that could have come up with any proving. It's not exclusive to that remedy. It's basically just the vibrational sort of energy of just doing any proving, which means that when we do a proving, we're trying to look exclusively at the remedy influence imposed upon the energy of the individual. And we are a conduit or a transformer for the energy of a remedy. Of course, when the remedy is kind of like, in a way, prismed through us individuals, it's reflected out in our own language, our own individual language. And so some of that inevitably gets included. That is, part of Richard would get included in the proving of whatever it was. But we still have to discriminate. What is the proving or what is Richard? And that's such a fine art. And I feel, actually, in the quest for quality of content, in the quest for breadth and depth in the proving, some modern provings have gone too far in including stuff that I think is not essentially part of the proving, and that other remedies would have produced similar things. And you'll see in a lot of provings a certain effect, which some people discriminate, and actually in an appropriate way call it the primary effect of the proving, in which it's actually, in a way, a temporary curative effect. People feel calm, more rational, more functional, more busy, more active. and say, well, that's part of the proving, that these people are more functional and proving and active than this. No, it's not. It's just a general boost from doing the remedy.
Mm.
It's not exclusive or in any way unique to that remedy,
mm-hmm.
but it gets included in the proving material.
Mm.
And I think that there's a real problem in that.
Mm.
So what I'm, my latest proving, what I've done is actually, unfortunately I had 9 provers, I wanted a few more. I chose not to have a supervisor for each one, just to see, but we would just do, I call it a short, sharp proving, where we just glean certain essential ingredients from the proving, create a very small number of rubrics, materia medica, and material on the proving, but bring it up into the consciousness of the profession in such a way that hopefully, even with this information, it can be used clinically and we can build on it and actually then develop its knowledge through appropriate clinical use. Because I have feel that in our attempt to revitalize provings, we've tried to make the proving something that it was never really meant to be, which is that we would be gleaning 98% of what's necessarily known about a remedy from the proving.
Hmm.
And that's never happened in the annals of homeopathy.
Sure.
So those people actually who always say, we have to go back to the provings are the only source. And often these people are people who critique some of the modern provings. But in fact, the provings have always been fraught with, you know, dubious information, stuff that's not been very validated, and Franz Vermeulen clarified that when he talked about one of the provers who was Hahnemann's prover of China, who brought out the feeling of contempt and the feeling of being persecuted. Where in fact he did another proving and brought out the same symptom. So what was, is this essentially about China or is this more about this individual prover? So there's been a tendency to over-glorify the authenticity of some of the original provings. Whereas in fact, some of our well-documented information comes from clinical verification. And I feel it's a balance of the two. Some homeopaths refute some of the clinical knowledge and saying, well, they have to go back to the provings. Clinical knowledge is subjective according to the individual nuances of the practitioner. And that's also true. But I feel it's no different a challenge than the quest for objectivity that we're supposedly meant to get from provings. So I feel it has to come from both. So what I'm trying to do now is smaller provings in which we get a taste, and enough of a taste in a way to up the remedy into the broad consciousness of homeopathy. And that way we can do more provings, because it took me, I mean, it took me 3 years to do the tobacco proving and write the book. It took over a year to do the petroleum and also the Taxus brevifolia, the Pacific yew tree. And this was a bucket load of work that was exhausting, you know? And I feel like, as I say, there are challenges however you do it. And so I fall right in the middle. I do believe they need to be blinded. The people should not know what the remedy is. Absolutely not. That even though actually in Hahnemann's time they did. But I think they shouldn't know what the remedy is. But I do not believe we have to have placebo. I know some people think, oh, you should always have placebo when you do provings. That's the only way to scientifically authenticate it or to make it acceptable to conventional medical methodology. But to be honest, practically, I don't care about that. I don't think it's important, and I don't think it's crucial. And I think I also feel it's actually philosophically obsolete. Meaning that in the modern era, with much more knowledge about concepts of a lot of what modern physics is talking about and quantum theory and all of that cutting-edge stuff, the concept that, you know, even someone who takes placebo is not going to be affected by the proving is irrelevant. If we're looking at something called the field effect, and I recommend a book by Lynn McTaggart, and the book is called The Field. And she's exploring a lot of these areas where basically we recreate fields of consciousness, patterns. Rupert Sheldrake talked about it with morphogenetic fields. Richard Tarnas has talked about it, who's a philosopher in San Francisco, in a book called Cosmos and Psyche. A lot of thinkers, and of course Jung and all those people, talk about these ideas of synchronicity and patterns. And I feel in homeopathy we create patterns when we do a proving, and we create a consciousness. And I think, therefore, people who take placebo and the people who coordinate the proving also become part of the proving, whether they like it or not. And modern physics talks about that. So when we get people in the homeopathic profession saying, no, such ideas are invalid, to me this is just reductionism. It's just materialism in another voice, and I think it's not actually appropriate or even accurate to represent what we experience when we do a proving.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard, that was a wonderfully eloquent and beautiful description. I particularly like your emphasis on the real purpose of approving really being something that allows us to confirm these things clinically. And you know, there was a statement that Franz Vermeulen made that I don't know if this is accurate or not, but it was a startling statement to me, which he said that in our provings only, and I don't know exactly how he came up with this information, but what he says essentially is that only 30% of the information from provings has been clinically verified in practice if you looked at all the symptoms. And that to me, that was always a startling statement in terms of the limitation of provings.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a challenge to bring what we bring from approving up into a clinical context that makes it applicable and useful. And that's one of the issues I have about some of the modern provings. And it's like, as a practitioner, I'm struggling, you know, to keep up. I'm actually researching this stuff, you know, and I'm still struggling to keep up and begin to apply it, you know. And it's a tough call to do it. So I think part of our quest is to create methodologies of access, which computer programs help us to some extent. I mean, I think whatever computer program you use, you should have a search that searches only provings. Have one that searches any modern provings. Try and find ways to access it if you want to go there. And at the same time, be really careful not to kind of like start giving wacky remedies when the obvious hits you right in the face. And I think there's a really fine balance in that way.
Richard, I'm curious, you know, and I look at a lot of the contemporary provings, they seem to have a lot of mental-emotional symptoms, a lot of dreams. You'll see some food desires and aversions, but really the brunt of it is the mind stuff.
Yeah.
When you look at Hahnemann's provings, you know, and Hale and some of these other people, there are mental-emotionals, but there's also a lot of physical symptoms as well. And I'm curious, in the proving that you did, or your provings with petroleum tobacco, did you have this similar type of situation, or did you get across the board symptoms coming from all the different areas?
No, very much all the areas. I focus a lot on the physicals, a lot more physicals. I actually do feel, on reflection, if people check out my first proving, which is Ataxis brevifolia, there were certain dreams inserted in there which, on reflection, I don't believe are valid. And I had a debate with my kind of coordinator at the time about that, and I feel, on reflection, we should not have included them. And in fact, a lot of the key symptoms in that proving came from physicals. And that's what I really wanted to emphasize in that proving. And actually, we got some really good clinical physical symptoms. And I do feel that in general, that is, I agree with you, a weakness of some of the modern provings is an overemphasis on the mind and dreams. And I feel that my Texas brevifolia, the nicotina I felt had definitely some dreams in there, but I felt that what we included was generally relevant in that respect. And I think the petroleum also, there was quite a lot of physicals that came through in the proving. And I agree that a good proving should have well-documented physical symptoms. Otherwise, I feel like it's questionable. You know?
Richard, you mentioned, you know, Rupert Sheldrake and morphogenetic fields, and you also mentioned, you know, Jung and the idea of, you know, collective unconscious archetypes and this idea that there are these fields around us and so on and so forth. And you also mentioned about synchronous events, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, this has become quite popular in certain segments of the homeopathic community where, you know, everything that happens at that time is seen to be as part of the proving process, and they'll include everybody's symptoms, even people who didn't take the remedy or who were walking by the street, or, you know, there was a solar eclipse, or, you know what I'm saying? So how do you understand this type of thing that happens? I mean, we do have these experiences of synchronicities. Have you experienced these in your proving, and what significance do you give to them?
So here's how I analyze it. I'll do a general analysis, then talk about my experience with the tobacco proving.
Okay.
If synchronous event in a homeopathic proving is only valid in context to its replication and your ability to totally objectively validate that not just one person, but other people experience something similar at the same time. Mm. In a way that really makes sense. It's like validating any symptom to be included in approving. You've got a few criteria. And I actually, in my problem is I try and limit the criteria because you have a new symptom. That is, someone said, I've never had that before and it was really strong. And I had that. And if it only one person experiences that, good enough. If you trust the person and it's objectively there, absolutely there. If it's not so clear, and this is either a new symptom or an altered symptom or an old symptom, but other people have it, then you include it. If someone says, well, I used to have this symptom and it came back on the remedy and they're the only one that had it, my inclination is not to include it because another remedy could have provoked that old symptom to come back as well.
Mm-hmm.
So to include it just because the remedy produced it is not good enough unless it's replicated. Now, with synchronicity, you're broadening out even further, and you're making some connections between even extraneous events that had nothing to do with the proving, potentially, or stuff that happened to people who didn't do the proving.
Mm.
If you understand the idea of the field effect, I still feel that those people who are connected emotionally to those people who do the proving are connected to the proving. And if they produce symptoms that can be validated by other people, therefore can be replicated by other people, then it's valid. If you can make the objective connection. You cannot just dismiss it, and at the same time you can't blanketly include it just because one person had a feeling that they haven't had before. If say, a prover's wife had a feeling in approving, she had this strange thing and she'd never had it before, but no one else had it, you don't include it. But if five or three or four other people had the same dizziness that the prover's wife had, then I think you could make a connection that there was some field effect going on. So it does exist. An example being, two examples. I did this proving recently of this substance, which I'm just writing up right now. Someone, and it was an old remedy, someone got a very strong symptom of that remedy, in which was actually violent diarrhea. The night before she even took the remedy, she had it at home. And out of the blue, she got this really, really strong diarrhea. She had no idea why. And the fact is that a coincidence? Could it have happened anyway? Perhaps. But when you study the material medical of that substance, of course you didn't know what it was. One of the keynote symptoms of that remedy was violent diarrhea.
Mm.
So what's going on?
Mm.
She is touching into the susceptibility, the gestalt of that substance even before taking it.
Mm.
Because if you believe in the whole idea of what we're talking about, when you get into the idea of the field effect and you get into this sort of quantum theory, post-time-space phenomena, there is a phenomena of consciousness outside of time and space, and that's what we're tapping into when we're doing proving, and it's all based on susceptibility. So someone is moving into the dynamic vibration of that proving even before they've actually taken the substance.
Mm-hmm.
Let me take you a bit further far out here, and it's documented in the tobacco book, and this is kind of neat. When we did the proving of Nicotina rusticum, and just as a preamble, there are two forms of tobacco commercially used. Nicotina tobacco, which we call tobacco, which is what we buy when we smoke our Camel and our, whatever we smoke, and that's the commercial form of tobacco that's been used, for the last 500 years, in the West. And there's a substance called Nicotina rusticum. And that's the indigenous form of cultivated tobacco that the shamans and the native people of both North and South America always used to smoke. When the white man came to North America, John Rolfe and these people to form the first colonies in Virginia, they tried to, farm Nicotina rustica, but they found that the smoke was rather astringent and harsh and also had a mild hallucinogenic effect to it. And then they started to cultivate the tamer form of tobacco, which is Nicotina tobacco, and they managed to cultivate that more successfully and then export it to Europe. And that actually led to the first colony surviving in North America. So tobacco is the father crop of North America. And it's the reason why the slaves came and everything else. So tobacco is intrinsically connected to the evolution of this country. So I chose to use Nicotina rustica, not Nicotina tobacco. The added reason is that it has four times more nicotine in it than Nicotina tobacco. So I thought, hey, if we're going to do it, let's do it right. And I felt
we're in America after all,
Yeah, And so let's find out. Let's use the authentic native tobacco, the tobacco that the shamans use, the tobacco that's been part of the folklore and symbolism and everything of these cultures. So I chose to do an experiment as such where when we did the proving, everyone came together. We actually kind of went out to the Marin Headlands just outside San Francisco in this beautiful kind of hostel surrounded by trees, very calm, very shanty, very nice. And everyone took the remedy together. No one knew what it was apart from me. So it wasn't a double blind. If it was double blind, I wouldn't have even known. So it's possible that I projected my consciousness and the power of my mind onto all these people and manipulated them. But anyway, that's another question. So then we all took it and meditated. And no one talked to one another. No one shared their experience. Did the California thing. Everyone just took the remedy, stayed quiet, and took notes about what they experienced in the first 2 hours being together. The idea of this was to create a vibration on a subtle level of the proving. And that if you took the remedy in your daily life, which also kind of makes sense practically, but somehow some of the subtlety could get missed, some of the initial hit of the remedy that you could share together. And I found it productive that when people spent that 2 hours, some subtle but significant information came out of that time that I think could have been missed. And I think as a methodology, I think that has validity. Again, no one knew what they were taking. Now, the canary here is that 2 hours before we did the proving, there was a mild earthquake in the Bay Area. And so people kind of obviously, some people have felt it, some people hadn't. But again, heck, we're all standing on the same land. Even if you're not consciously aware of it, your body is. Something was up. So as we were there, people wrote down notes. And over the first few days, people continued to write notes. Now, some people made reference to earthquakes and abysses, chasms opening up in the earth. Going from the heavens from above to the depths below to tombs under the ground. But definitely the quality and the phenomena of the earthquake came through in it. Now, what do I do? Extract and delete everything that has to do with an earthquake? In theory, yeah, because we're not proving earthquake. So, maybe we should have invalidated the whole proving and just chucked it away. Or do we just kind of like integrate it as seems appropriate? And I chose to do the latter. But in my preamble to the book and the proving, I explain that to give people an idea so they can take or leave it as they see fit.
Very interesting.
So then we carry on, and then I started to study some aspects of the proving and put it together. And then what we actually chosen is in the book here, there's a folklore image of the Iroquois Nation. And it's a whole story about the evolution of the Iroquois Nation. And I include it in the book, because part of the book is a study of the use of tobacco by the Native Americans and actually how they understood it. And this is called The Story of the Creation of Turtle Island, retold from the tales of the five nations of the, I can never pronounce it, the Haudenosaunee League, which is the Iroquois Nations. And in that story, there is a point at which a girl called Broken Flowers is thrown off an abyss into a cavern, floats to the ground, and is met by loons, and she's holding tobacco in her hand. So there's an interesting concept of an abyss there. And then at the back of the book, there's a case in which conventional tobacco was used, not by me, but my friend. And this is a guy who had very classic symptoms of tobacco, kidney disease and heart symptoms and all the symptoms that we understand in the proving of tobacco. But he then starts talking about being on the edge of an abyss and feeling as if he's always on this edge, as if he could fall into this abyss. So again, there's an interesting parallel drawn through clinical knowledge and observation, paralleled in the Native American folklore use of it and the weaving in tobacco into that story and in the proving. So I felt like there was some validation to include some of this information. And then I actually talked to a friend of mine who said that, I told her about the proving and talked about strange events, and she said, I always carry tobacco with me. And when I took it, she said, one time I had a dream of being back in the times of the American independence time, And she had this sort of vivid imagery. And she said, the day I was due to fly to San Francisco to begin a job, there was an earthquake that prevented me flying. And the day I was due to leave, there was also another earthquake. And so what is going on in all these situations? And the fact is, we don't really know, you know. But there are certain things and phenomena that do occur. And I think you include them using objectivity and using true, you know, exploration and implement it as you see fit. And I'm open to discussion that, you know, some of the symptoms in the proving were due to earthquake, and we can debate whether there is some connection of intrinsically between earthquakes and tobacco. But the concept of abyss, and this is what I do stand behind, and as if you're moving between two realities, is a key part of the tobacco proving. And this is where it gets really, I think, the most important thing. Because one of the key parts of tobacco in the proving is a feeling between being between two worlds, between the dark and the light, between sleep and awake. And a number of provers had a similar feeling. They said, I feel as if I'm just between this being awake and asleep. I'm not quite sure where I am. And they had this tangible experience of being between these two different feelings of the dark and the light. And that was, even if you exclude the earthquake phenomena, this feeling that between the dark and the light, between sleep and awake, came through very strongly. And people had a feeling as if rising up, floating up, and then sinking down, which again ties into the original proving of nicotine or tobacco, in which one of the key physical symptoms is a sinking feeling. Sinking in the stomach. Sinking nausea. Deathly nausea. Why is the word deathly nausea used? It's interesting, that word. Because tobacco is not that far from death. And so you have to have a connection to the underworld, to death. That's why that word is used. And that's why tobacco clinically has been used for states of unconsciousness, subconscious states, comas, unconsciousness, death-like states. That's why it's comparable with camphor, arsenicosin, arsenicum, and all these other remedies, because it has a similar clinical pathology. And if you study the shamans and the way they use tobacco clinically, some of them would take it so much that they would be on the edge of death. And they would take it in such toxic amounts, they would go into states of unconsciousness. And this would be their test in order to prove their shamanic power. And this is how they use tobacco. So on one level you get the sinking state, the deathly dark state, and the other side of it, especially in Nicotina rustica, is a floating feeling, as if floating in the air. And you'll see this in the proving of tobacco as well, as if you're floating up. So what we saw coming through in this proving, which we did not see in the toxicology, is the opposite of the sinking, which is the floating up to other worlds, feeling as if you're going to other worlds, which again is paralleled in the Native American use of tobacco, because they say that smoking tobacco attracts the spirits, because the spirits use tobacco as food. And in fact, tobacco is a food, and it grows as a plant like food. And for the spirits, they love tobacco. So when you smoke tobacco, you attract the spirits. And that's why tobacco is always used as a conduit between this world and the other world, between the physical world and the spirit world. And that's how the native people have always used it. And I feel that that was validated in a clinical context in the proving. So what I tried to do, therefore, with the book was to do a substantial Hanumanian proving, and then do a broader analysis and study of the substance from an anthropological, economic, political, and social point of view, and weave it into our bigger image of the substance itself. And I felt like tobacco merited that kind of study because it's such an intrinsic substance to human experience. It's so crucial in our experience, you know, especially for the white man in the last 500 years. It's spread more quickly than any other substance ever has in its use, you know. Within 50 years of us arriving in America, you know, where the first tobacco colony was sent, it was used throughout Europe and on and on and on. And so I think it has validity to study the substance in a broader way to help complement and balance the material from the proving. And to do it with some degree of discretion as well, because I feel like, again, the proving material has to stand on its own. It is the foundation. So really, for me, approving is like when you build a house, you know, you've got to build the foundations and you build the structure, and that's the main proving. You've got a house now that may or may not have a wall, but you can see the shape of it and the structure of it, but it doesn't have color yet. You don't know what the wallpaper is or the carpet or the furniture. That's clinical. But you have the structure, the frame, the foundation, and the basic building blocks of it. And that's what the proving offers. But a proving won't give everything. Anyway, that was a...
Richard, that was a wonderful answer. And the description of all those synchronicities as they relate to Tobacco is fascinating. It really reminds me that we live in a wonderfully mysterious universe. There's a lot of things that we just don't understand about it, but that there are these magical synchronicities that that are amazing to experience and discover. I'm curious, since we were talking about these fields and the whole subjectivity and different things affecting other things, I'm curious, when you were doing these provings, did you find that the experience of the... when going over the proofs, did you see the coordinator's own prejudice or subjectivity? Would that affect the material that was being presented just the way any other field could?
I think it can. I think this, as the coordinator, you know, you have a unique responsibility to look at your own kind of stuff in that way and to be careful not to project your own state into the proving. Now, one could say by default, even the choice of the remedies that you choose to prove already reflect a certain prejudice or susceptibility into certain substances. And I think it's actually interesting sometimes to look at, for example, when a prover or a proving coordinator has done a number of provings, where do you find those remedies? Are they all found in similar rubrics? You know, for example, like totally different substances are found consistently in similar rubrics. Then you could make a claim that, well, maybe there is some aspect of the prover found, or the coordinator, sorry, found in that proving material. Yeah. And that's one of the issues I think that any coordinator has to accept, that you are part of it, you know? Therefore, it is absolutely possible that some of you can come through that. And that's why there has been, I think, a really decent and concerted attempt to try and create objective protocols to do provings by, so that this can ideally be eliminated. But absolutely, I think it can happen, you know, and I think we have to be careful. Is that the case in my case? You know, it's hard for me to be totally objective. Maybe I'm not the one to do that for myself because, you know, I don't know. I mean, I've chosen, you know, three remedies. One is a mineral, two are plants, and I can see that there are certain aspects perhaps, but it's difficult to say. But I think there is always that risk involved.
So, Richard, you've conducted 4 provings now, is that correct?
Yeah.
And so, obviously, people don't realize, unless they've actually done a proving, the amount of effort and time and energy that's required. Having done 4 provings now, I'm sure that you've had some very interesting experiences. I'm curious, what would you say is the most important thing you've learned doing all these provings?
I actually get really excited by it still because I talk about, you know, I mean, the word shamanism is used a lot nowadays, and everyone leaps onto this word as if, and I can see why, and we're all trying to reconnect to the source in a way, and that kind of symbolism represents a sort of an attempt to kind of come back to some original source of knowledge outside of the mechanistic model of modern science and the, you know, absurdities of a lot of modern medicine, and so I can see why we're looking back at that original knowledge. And I only mention that because I do feel in homeopathy, though, it is our form of Western shamanism. We are literally diving into the consciousness of whatever we're proving to explore what it's really about.
Mm.
We're trying to find out, hey, how does this plant think?
Mm.
How does petroleum think? What does petroleum do, you know?
Mm.
And how are we going to find out? Let's take it. Let's do it. And this actually brings up an interesting idea about even how the potencies, because and Herfew talks about this in his book on the proving of alcohol, that toxic substances should be proven in a 12C, you know, minimum. And I actually believe that in non-toxic substances, we should start actually lower down in a 6C.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of information, again, comes from toxicology. Mm. And our books are full of that, from herbal law, basic toxicology, and what have you. And they actually, in some ways, give us really valid information.
Mm-hmm.
And if we start with a 30C, which I did with my last proving because that's all I had, I actually think you get less of an initial effect in some ways, or not everyone's going to be affected because the susceptibility is greater the higher up you go. That means less people will be affected the higher the potency, like a remedy. And therefore, I think with provings, one should ideally start lower down and do that. But I feel, coming back to the point, that this is what we're trying to do with provings. We're trying to explore nature, trying to explore substance. And I mentioned a very quick thing, which I found intriguing, about the petroleum proving. Now, to be honest, even though petroleum was only proven by one person, and Hahnemann did a proving on himself, and a man called Berridge, I think, did one other proving, there's no other documentation, I think, of a substantive clinical proving being done with one of the more ubiquitous substances that we've, you know, known to man.
Sure.
You know, we still have managed to glean from that a pretty good clinical effect of the remedy. And at the same time, we have had to deal with a situation in which many of the old texts talk about this as being a major polycrest, blah, 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 but not many people use it as such. So there seems to be something missing in it as well. Part of that is that no one knew what Hahnemann proved. No one knew. He called it a type of Burmese Rangoon oil, but Rangoon oil wasn't even created until about 1853. He did the proving before that. So it wasn't Rangoon oil. And this is talked about in the new book by Roger Morrison, the book on carbon. And he talks about petroleum there. And I write it also on a preamble to my proving, and that comes from John Morgan at the Helios Pharmacy in England, in which they supplied me with a new petroleum. And he chose to use actually a form of kerosene because it was, at that time, the most easily accessed form of petroleum that was really standardized and that you could replicate very easily. So in fact, what I've reproven is a form of petroleum. There are other provings of petroleum, including petroleum crudum from Norway and a couple of other ones. And it would be interesting to do a cross comparison to see the similarities. But what do we know about petroleum? All we have to do is study the Middle East. Power, aggression, acquisitiveness, explosion, heat, rage. I mean, and you say, well, that's just an anecdotal kind of projection. This is ridiculous, you know? And then here's a proving I had, though. And this is, and I'll just share two very basic things. And this came from the proving. I was driving a car, an old Ford Mustang, with my daughter and her best friend in the back seat. I was driving really fast and peeling the tires around the corners, driving in the shoulders off the roads to get where I wanted to go, peeling around town. We were having fun, laughing, hair blowing in the wind kind of thing. Then we got home in the driveway, and I realized the two tires on the driver's side were flat. Not just flat, but the rubber was worn off from skidding. My daughter's friend said that her mum would be so mad that I had flattened her tires. I then realized the car wasn't mine and I needed to have the tires repaired. I woke up thinking about if I was going to go to the auto club or just down to Discount Tire. I felt perplexed that the tires were flat. Even the spare was flat and that the old car was so old and disintegrating. And this came through in the proving, you know. And I said there was a theme that came through in the whole proving here, which was of speed, deflation, playfulness, anger, aggressiveness, disintegration, which actually came through. There was a lot of aggression, violence, anger, a feeling of threat, hot, feeling of being attacked, hostility, confrontation, violence, conflict, ultimately leading to death and murder. This came through in the proving. Stabbing pains like knives, sharp shooting, stitching sensations, irritation, impatience, and rage, control, power, aggression, burning heat, rawness, dryness, itching, and on and on and on. Relationship to alcohol. People thought, I can consume much more alcohol than I normally can. I feel like I can, my capacity to drink is that much greater. Study original symptoms is a remedy for alcoholism. It's a great alcoholic remedy. And this came through in the proving. And this thing of greed came through in very strong ways. And one man, a very nice man, he would have this dream normally of going on a holiday with his friends to his, with his family to this house in the country. And they would always go on holiday there and he'd always have the same dream. He had the same dream this time. The only difference being is that he said, I have to own this house. I've got to have it. And he went off to buy it, to borrow the money so he could buy the house. So what was interesting then, and it's interesting in understanding proving protocol, the themes of the house and the family were not really what was important. What was important was this thing of acquisition, of buying, of having to have. He said, I never had that before, that I had to have it. So I think sometimes you get even one salient, juicy symptom like that, and you tap into the essence of the remedy.
Hmm.
You tap into something really key. And I think you can do that with provings, where one or two people will give you the essential ingredients of the proving, something very, very essential in the proving. And that's why some provers or coordinators emphasize one or two provers who they call sensitive provers, because they can really key into the essence. And I think that's a really important part of provings to see.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so petroleum, I wanted to find out, let's find out what it's about. Because without petroleum products, we would not be where we were today.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Good and for bad, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Richard, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the tobacco book and the proving in general. Could you tell us a little bit about how you conducted the proving and if anything interesting happened, and maybe also tell us a little bit about just the basic themes of tobacco that you discovered during the proving, just so we have kind of an overview?
Yeah. First of all, just to let you know, I kind of came to the idea of doing it through reading a book called The Cosmic Serpent. And that's a book written by Jeremy Narby, and he is an anthropologist who spent years in the jungles of Peru and the Amazonia in general, especially studying indigenous cultures and their use of a hallucinogenic plant called ayahuasca. And ayahuasca is one of the main hallucinogenic plants of those cultures, similar to how the way peyote has been in North America. It's a very strong, powerful substance, and in those cultures, the shamans use it as a means to study the knowledge of the world. And Narby postulates that it connects you to the DNA level of reality, in which you connect to some central level of knowledge of the planet, and you become, in a way, a vehicle for the transformation of knowledge that ayahuasca opens you up to. And it's now part of the ceremony of two churches based in Brazil that also can be used here. And interestingly enough, just to kind of as a side angle here, ayahuasca has now been actually legally allowed to be used in the United States, similar to peyote has, as part of religious ceremony of a Brazilian church, which is now established here in the United States.
Mm.
So it's interesting in America's war on drugs and all of the paranoia and aspects and things about that, it now actually went all the way to the Supreme Court. At each stage of the court, the government lost its case, saying this is a class one dangerous drug, and the courts voted in favor of using it as a religious substance. And even at the Supreme Court, even people like Antonin Scalia and all those strange individuals even voted in favor of using it, mainly because they actually
themselves
were
personally, or other people could.
No, other people. No,
oh.
I'm sure they could benefit from it. But
I'm just joking.
You know, yeah, and fine, and so. Anyway, so it's actually a very interesting substance. Now, in the jungle there, they actually use tobacco as part of the journey with the ayahuasca, and the tobacco is really a kind of like a brother to the ayahuasca as a means to communicate with the spirit world. Also, Nicotina rustica has aspects of harmaline in it, and harmaline is a compound which actually, similar to ayahuasca, has mild hallucinogenic effect. So I just said, wow, this form of tobacco is really interesting, and that's what led me to do the study of it.
Hmm.
You know, and I thought, well, let's find out. And then we got some actually online, and Nicotina rustica is easily available to buy, to smoke, you know, naturally as you would other forms of tobacco, but it's not in any way, artificially prepared or filled with the other, you know, toxic substances that the drug companies fit it with. So anyway, that was the kind of the preamble to kind of doing this proving. And part of the study, as you know, we have been looking more at botanical relationships, really, in the last number of years, and you know, revisiting this idea of relationships of based on botany, was to look at tobacco as part of the family of the Solanaceae.
Mm-hmm.
And we know the most common Solanaceae remedies are belladonna, hyoscyamus, stramonium, mandragora. Those are the most commonly used ones,
mm-hmm.
And I call those the dark Solanaceae.
Mm-hmm.
You only have to study toxicology of all of those anyway to understand their effect. They are very dark. The hallucinations are very strong. The physical effects are very toxic. Tobacco is in between that, between those dark ones and the lighter ones, which are dulcamara, tomatoes, Solanum nigrum, you know, and Solanum tuberosum, Solanum pluricum, egretans, potato, and eggplant, and all of those remedies that are also Solanaceae, but as we've talked about before, Kim, don't seem to have much in common with the darker ones.
Sure.
And in fact, in many ways, there isn't seemingly that much in connection with them, you know? You see some aspects of blackness and black discharges in tomato, in Solanum nigrum, but you don't see that so much in the others. And so there is a question about that. However, tobacco does have similarities to Stramonium and Belladonna. Mm. And actually, Harry van der Zee, the Dutch homeopath and editor of Lynx, presented a couple of very interesting cases of tobacco in which it looked like it was a Stramonium case, in which the etiology was one of emotional shock. And in one case, it was a person traveling on a journey, driving up in the Swiss Alps under a very narrow road, as if going up on the edge of an abyss, which is very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
And the person had a lot of fright and shock and terror that looked just like Stramonium. And he gave tobacco with really, really good effect. So there is a correspondence with it, with those other remedies that we know, you know. And that's one thing. The other thing that came through, as I mentioned in the proving, is a feeling of separation from the body. There's a feeling of disconnection, a lightness, a floating up. And that's where it looks like other drug remedies. And you have to study tobacco with other drug remedies, like cannabis indica. You know, like opium, like coca, you've got to study them with some of those. Because this came through a lot. Another thing was falling, sinking, like I mentioned before, falling in the earth, going down. This came through. Other worlds, universe, vaults, cracks, space, opening up. Half asleep, half awake, these transitional states. These are themes I'm reading now, and this came through a lot. Feeling not quite here. Beauty, light came through. Feeling of beauty and light. Blackness, darkness, and that came through a lot. This black, dark, a lot of darkness and black aspects came through. Birds, themes of birds came through. And again, there's been a lot of thing about bird remedies and birds, birds, birds. But it's interesting how this person said, I thought that the coordinator, that me, looked like a raptor bird. This is what one of the provers said. A feeling of a long nose, beak, air coming through the bridge of the nose. That's where I feel the air coming through, like where the holes on a water bird's bill are, you know, as the air goes through there. Lightness came through. Some mental clarity came through. Now, you could say, similar to what I said at the beginning, well, that's just a common effect of all the remedies. But we know that people who smoke, it creates clarity of mind. And one of the quotes at the beginning of the book is funny. I quote, actually, Oscar Wilde, a cigarette is the perfect type of a perfect pleasure. It is exquisite, and it leaves one unsatisfied. What more can one want? Perfect. Yeah. And Albert Einstein, I believe that pipe smoking contributes to a somewhat calm and objective judgment in all human affairs. And then another quote, which I think is an interesting one. Those human cultures which demonize death or pain or sickness are thus less able to deal with the bitter side of nature, with intoxications, and make themselves doubly sick. Which may respond to the attitude of the Western man in their relationship to tobacco. Instead of using it as a sacrament, as something to be used to connect, we use it as a means to disconnect in a way. We use it as a means to suppress fear and anger, more than we do as a more creative purpose of connecting. So partly it's not just tobacco itself, it's also the way we use it and the consciousness in the way we use it, which is important. So those are some of the mental symptoms. The dreams came through a lot about, again, half awake and half asleep, out of the body, above the earth, coming into the earth. The vertigo is a key aspect, coming to physicals. One prover had vertigo for 1 month. Really difficult vertigo, and as we know, Keynote Vertigo's remedies. And that was verified very strongly.
Richard, we're just running out of time. I just wanted to tell you, I heard the beep sound. It shouldn't happen, but unfortunately it is coming on.
So. All right, good. Fair enough.
You got a few minutes. You can go ahead and sum up whatever you'd like.
Well, that's it, really. I mean, that was really it. There's a lot more that came through. The stomach symptoms, the sinking feeling was verified, which we can see in the original proving. That came through very strongly. And you know, there was a fair amount of other symptoms. There's neurological symptoms, there's heart symptoms, and
I guess they can get your book and read it in all its full detail as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the book...
Let me just mention that to people. I mean, obviously you can tell that Richard's done an immense amount of research And just so you know, he's got an amazingly eloquent writing style. It's really a joy to read his writings. So it's a very well-written book, very well-researched, and it's a very well-done proving as well. The title of the book is Tobacco, An Exploration of Its Nature Through the Prism of Homeopathy. We do sell it at Whole Health Now Books. If anybody's interested in acquiring a copy, you can call toll-free 866-599-5950. That's 866-599-5950. And Richard, is there anything, if people want to contact you to find out more about the work that you're doing or more about your school or classes, how can they reach you?
Just go to my website, which is richardpitt.com, or the school website, which is health-academy.org.
Okay, and Pitt is P-I...
Well, homeopathy-academy.org.
Homeopathy-academy.org.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Richard Pitt is P-I-T-T is the
yeah.
of your last name.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Is there anything else with people before I open it up and let everybody thank you personally?
No, that's it.
Okay, well, first of all, let me thank you, Richard, because as always, you did a fabulous job, and I learned a tremendous amount, so I want to personally thank you. Let me open it up and let everybody else thank you as well. Hold on one second. So can we give Richard a big thank you?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.